Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What people, places, and ideas shaped Charlie Parker into an artist who would forever change music in a professional career that lasted just half of his tragically short life? Parker was born in Kansas City in 1920 and came of age there at a time when the city's clubs came alive every night with the sounds of some of the era's most influential band leaders and musicians, and the best of the best literally competed to earn their places. Parker's first attempts to join them were infamously inauspicious, but as my guest today will tell us, those early humiliations seemed to have ignited a kind of disciplined passion for music that he could not match in other aspects of his life. MacArthur Prize-winning author Stanley Crouch is president of the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation and a columnist for the New York Daily News. His new book is called Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. Stanley, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you.
The story goes that you have been working on this book here and there for 30 years, during which time you've published prolifically on other subjects. What was it about Charlie Parker that demanded so much more from you?
Well, I had to learn a lot of things that I made mention of in his biography. I had to learn a lot about American film, more and more about jazz. I had to learn different things about history and American politics, because a lot of things have to be known to actually compress them into a narrative so that the reader feels as though he or she is there. So the ambition is to make the data feel literally like the air of the time. It's just something that you just breathe in, you know. So that takes a long time to get to. I mean, I had the data far more quickly than the book came out, but I couldn't make it come alive.
Yeah, when you want to make a time and a place come alive that you have not, I mean, this all happened before you were born. So there's research you can find by looking up newspapers and hearing recordings, but there's got to be more to it than that. Is that the idea? It has to sort of germinate in your head in order to have the ability to express it on the page?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, there are a lot of literary things in terms of literary technique that I did not have when I began the book. But... So in other words, for instance, if I interviewed somebody like Buster Smith, who was a band leader that influenced Charlie Parker enormously and who also employed Charlie Parker, well, see, when I would listen to his tapes, I would begin to hear the rhythm of his voice. When I wanted to take something from the first person and put it in the third person, instead of him saying, yes, and then I went to so-and-so place, and Lester Young and I did X, Y, and Z, then if I changed it to third person, it would still be his voice, but it wouldn't obviously be his voice. And so that's one of the things that happens in the narrative, is that the subject actually influences the sound of the narrative.
You mentioned Buster Smith. People may or may not know that he was from Dallas. You say that listening to Buster Smith made Charlie Parker realize for the first time what a saxophone could do. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, see, the thing is that Buster Smith was one of the great voices in Kansas City jazz. Now, he was from Dallas, and he had been one of what they call the Blue Devils, which was a band led by the great bassist Walter Page in Oklahoma City. But he went to he and Lester Young went out on an ill-fated tour and got stranded, and they had to hitchhike back to, hobo back to Oklahoma City from, you know, around, you know, Maryland, West Virginia, that sort of place. And in telling his tale, the narrative shifts to get a sound like his voice sounded, you know. So you're actually hearing Buster Smith speaking in the first person, but transferred into the third person. Hmm. So that was a literary technique that I used a number of times, based upon who was talking, who had told me what on the tape. It's not because I wanted to get that sound without fudging the facts. See, the biggest obstacle for a biographer is to take the data and make the data come alive without changing the facts, or without fudging them, or without adding anything that was not there. And so that happened. I'm fairly happy with the book because I think you get these voices that keep coming through the book, and the purpose of that is to make the book and the period come alive. Because, see, that was a truly astonishing time in American life, because the people were so serious, they worked so hard, they were surrounded by so much corruption, they were liberated at the same time in certain circumstances by that corruption. And they did many things that we today in America think are fairly new, but were really kind of old. They weren't old, but they were being done then. As an example, what we call multitasking today is often done on a jazz bandstand. Hmm. That is because the person has to learn how to hear so that he or she hears accurately what everyone else is playing, hears the response to them, and hears all of this at once and performs. So what we call digital speed today, you know, can be proven with our technology that, you know, jazz musicians have been doing that for many years.
What kind of energy existed musically and culturally in Kansas City around the time that Charlie Parker was growing up there?
Well, firstly, Kansas City was a real competitive and combative town, in the sense that many bands from the East came through Kansas City and thought they were going to either do well at the jam sessions or just run those hicks, you know, back into the bushes somewhere.
Right.
And see, that was not what happened. Because Kansas City became known as a place, the best thing for you to do when you get off work is go there with carry unarmed, no saxophone, no trumpet, no drumsticks, nothing. Just sit there and listen. Because if you messed around and got up on that bandstand in Kansas City, you might have something very rough put on you. And Kansas City musicians, they not only could do that, they enjoyed doing it, because that was really what they liked to do.
And they did it to Charlie Parker when he first got up there.
Oh, yeah, well, he was just, Charlie Parker was just a well-dressed, small boy who had a saxophone, who felt that because people had always given him what he wanted, that is his mother, that he could just do what he wanted to do. So he had a saxophone. He figured he could play, so he jumped up there and he found out he not only couldn't play, but that the musicians would actually start laughing at him. And so they really made him mad. And so part of his personality was this. See, Charlie Parker had a number of weaknesses in his appetites for sensation, for substances, for a number of things. But he was like the epic hero in the Iliad, in the Odyssey. because an epic hero, a mythological hero, is always he's always a double personality. He has virtues on the one hand, and he has shortcomings on another. And the reason that he's a hero is because he comes out by winning his shortcomings, by winning over his shortcomings. And Charlie Parker, even after he became addicted to heroin, which at that time no one knew much about, he still had the focus and the will to practice 12 to 15 hours a day. It did not matter with him. I mean, he wanted to play the saxophone so much that he was not going to let anything hold him back. And I've noticed thus far that the tendency of certain writers to discuss Charlie Parker is to focus on the fact that he was a drug addict, that he did what he did. But see, the book is really about the triumph of Charlie Parker because he had to go through all of his problems to master that saxophone. It didn't matter how much talent he had. He still had to master the saxophone, and after mastering the saxophone, he had to go to the next level, which was to learn how to fit with the band on the bandstand, even though he ended up inventing another style.
Well, let me have you stop there. We need to take a quick break, and I want to hear more about that in just a minute. My guest is Stanley Crouch. He is president of the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation and a columnist for the New York Daily News. His new book is called Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We want to remind you that we are in our fall fundraising campaign right now and invite you to call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. Think producer Stephen Becker joins us in studio now. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Chris. You know, this is an important time to remind people that to kick off the drive, we're giving away 4 iPads. And the first of those iPads is going to be given away at 1 p.m. That's if you've got a clock, that's within the hour. So it's important that if you want to be entered in for that drawing, you go ahead and make your contribution now. And the good thing is that if you get in for that 1 o'clock drawing, you'll also be eligible for all the other drawings that we've got going. So why not give yourself the best chance possible by going ahead and making that contribution now and getting entered in for all 4 drawings?
We are speaking this hour, of course, with Stanley Crouch about his new book, Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. We have thank you gift copies available with a gift of $120. You can do $10 a month. And it really is an amazing piece of writing. If you read a lot of biographies, this is probably unlike any that you have read before. The writing style here is amazing. What Mr. Crouch was telling us about the sort of effort that he made to get the voice of people, even when he's writing in the third person, absolutely comes through. And it's just a fascinating portrait, not only of Parker himself, but of the places that he visited.
And if you've seen, for example, Ken Burns' jazz series, you know Stanley Crouch is as much a part of that series as the actual, you know, jazz legends who are featured in it. So this is a man that knows about what he's writing about. It'd be a great book to take home at the $120 level. 888-694-6931 is where you can make that contribution, or go online to kera.org.
Your support of KERA is what allows us to bring you amazing MacArthur Prize-winning guests like Stanley Crouch to talk about Charlie Parker in depth for an hour. That happens because of listener support. You can get on board by going online to kera.org or calling in to 1-888-694-6931. Back in 2 minutes with Stanley Crouch.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
That was a bit of Charlie Parker playing Honeysuckle Rose there on the alto sax with the J. McShann Orchestra in 1940. My guest is Stanley Crouch, whose new book is called Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Stanley, before we talk more about the development of his career, I have to say, listening to that cut, and I am not a musician, but it's astonishingly fast the way he's playing.
Well, that was one of the things that he brought to the music. He was able to play at a velocity that nobody else had played melody at the speed that he did. Now, the great Art Tatum, the blind pianist from Cleveland, he could play what they call broken chords that fast. And other people could play broken chords perhaps that fast. But in terms of playing melodic lines at that speed, that had not been done. It's still, even in the wake of Parker's death, few people can play melody at that speed. You know, they can play a lot of broken chords. Coltrane was a good example of that. But to hear melody, that's always the great gift in music. It's because that may be the thing that unites most music and rhythm. You know, and Charlie Parker was a master of both. He could invent melodies, and his rhythm was second to none. He and Louis Armstrong probably had the very best rhythm of anyone who's ever played jazz.
Can you talk about his practice schedule? Because it's funny, on the one hand, as you referred to earlier, he struggled with drugs. He had, you know, great appetites for women of all kinds. But he had an amazing kind of discipline when it came to practicing his instrument.
Oh, well, his gift was that he could focus. When he actually wanted to listen to something, he could focus on it. I mean, wanted to learn something, he could focus on it and not be swayed by all of these appetites and things that made him seem to be a completely chaotic personality. He wasn't. He put in those hours on the saxophone every day. You know, he studied music every day. He read books every day. You know, because he was a very intellectually curious guy, so he kept his perception up as far as he could keep it up, and he maintained his relationship to developing his perception and bettering it and becoming more precise in his music and in what he understood about science, about machinery, because he was a classic American guy of the 1930s, he magazines about science. He was interested in aviation. He was interested in all of that because that's part of the American identity. And see, Charlie Parker was not, as I've called it often in essays, he did not exist in a side pocket of reality. I mean, he existed inside of Americana, just like everybody else. There's far too long been a fundamental stereotype about Americana in which we think or are told to think that if someone was from a minority group, supposedly, or was a female, you know, actually, they somehow weren't excited by the same things that everybody else was. But, you know, I made it a point to show that when Charlie Parker and his first wife went to the movies, they experienced the movies like everybody else. I mean, they knew that there were things in the world that were true that they saw on the screen, and they knew that there were things that were not true. And so there's an excitement to the period, and I wanted to make sure that the reader never ended up thinking like, oh, Charlie Parker and those poor colored people in the 1930s in Kansas City, all they could do was just crawl along because the white man's boot was on them, pushing them down too hard. That wasn't true. Not that there wasn't segregation and that there wasn't bigotry, but inside the music itself and inside the time period and inside the world of the human imagination, they were equal to anybody else, and they knew it.
Would you say, Stanley, that Charlie Parker, this drive to play, to practice, to learn everything he could, was that motivated by a drive for happiness? Was he happy when he was playing, or was it something else?
I think he experienced a kind of exuberant joy from playing music and from hearing music and from relating to the things that were going on around him when he actually got to the point where he could actually understand what was happening around him. Because one of the most important ideas in the book is that one can have no more talent than Charlie Parker had. He was a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Physically, and his ability to retain material was remarkable, but he couldn't play jazz when he got up on that bandstand. He had to learn the same thing that everybody who plays jazz has to learn. He had to learn how to hear and hear with the kind of empathy that all jazz players have to use. By as I was saying earlier, by multitasking when they're on a bandstand. So as great as Charlie Parker was and as great as he was to become, he still, like everybody else, started out not being able to play. Right? So it's kind of hard for people to ever imagine that there was a period when Louis Armstrong could not play, when Coltrane could not play. You know, people can't imagine that, but it's true. Nobody comes out of the womb who's able to play jazz. It's too hard to do.
What drew him and Rebecca Ruffin, his first wife, together over considerable parental objections? We'll put it that way.
They were just attracted to each other. You know, she fell in love with him the first time she saw him. He because the first thing was he seemed like a little dream prince. He was a handsome old boy, but he was very shy, and he wasn't aggressive towards her, and he paid a lot of attention. And what she said about him was that he learned very quickly, and once the Ruffin family actually moved into the house of Eddie Parker, his mother.
She had a boarding house.
Yeah. Charlie ended up having three sisters who were always lively and wanted to learn how to play the piano from him, and they wanted to go places and they had things on their mind, and you know, so suddenly this guy who was kind of like who was a kind of shy guy who didn't talk much or interact with people much. Rebecca started witnessing him coming out of that, and in a way, that female force, that young female force gathered in that house, they pulled him out of his loneliness and out of his isolation and brought him deeper into life. And he he became another kind of person then, and Rebecca, she gave him something that he needed, you know, just because she said that she felt that his mother gave him everything that he wanted, but to her, to Rebecca, she didn't seem like she gave him emotionally what he needed.
Hmm.
And so all of those girls, they made him like all the girls were there, and there was a brother named Winfrey, but he basically stayed to himself. He was kind of a Charlie Parker sort because he stayed to himself and mostly read books. But those girls made him like a surrogate brother, you know, and so he came alive. You know, he wasn't dead when they came, but he really wasn't as involved in life as he became once he fell under their influence. And they made him feel like another person, and they gave him the feeling of a family, and they made him feel like he could do different things. And so that's, you know, in terms of the narrative taking on a certain kind of warmth, at that place the narrative kind of shifts in that direction because it was a very joyful time for him and for them.
Stanley Crouch is with us. We're talking about his new book, Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or calling in to 1-800-933-5372. We'll talk more with Stanley Crouch in a few minutes. Right now, we would encourage you to please go online to kera.org or call 888-694-6931. You still have time to A, make your contribution to KERA, and B, get in on that drawing for an iPad. It's an iPad Air, right? The brand new one.
Correct. It's an iPad Air. And, you know, I think it is worth, again, underscoring the fact that if you get your contribution in before 1 p.m., which is coming up fastly approaching, you know, you can get basically one more entry in because we're going to give away four of these. And if you get your entry in, you'll be eligible for all four. So why not give yourself, I guess, a 25% better chance at winning by going ahead and making that contribution at 888-694-6931 or online at kera.org.
Your contribution to public radio ensures that you and your gift really reach a very wide community. If you're thinking about philanthropy, there's a great bang for your buck here. Not only do you use the service all the time, but I think the statistic is that KERA touches more people than any not-for-profit in the North Texas region.
That sounds right to me. I know that also we've seen just a really big bump in listenership over the last few weeks. I was just talking to our program director, Jeff Ramirez, who was smiling very widely because more and more people are listening to KERA on a daily and weekly basis. So that touch that you mentioned is certainly being expanded even further across North Texas. And I think, you know, it's due to in part because we've expanded our local news coverage here. You might have heard our extended blocks that air at 8:20 a.m. and 6:20 p.m. during our newscasts. And that's just because the station has, you know, really a dedication to covering North Texas, I think, as much or more as anyone.
And yes, we ask you to pay with your contributions at kera.org or 888-694-6931. But of course, as the saying goes, if the product is free, then you are the product. We are not selling you to advertisers. We instead are coming directly to you and saying, is this the kind of programming you want? Is this unusual and unduplicated in this listening area? Perhaps maybe you listen to the podcast online and you can't find anything else like Think Online. Your contribution makes it possible for us to do this for you in a commercial-free way.
And if you are a regular listener to Think, as we hope you are, I'm sure you've, you know, you can tell that the guests that we have on the show, I mean, Stanley Crouch, perfect example. These are pretty big gets, you know, and guests that people are interested in all around the country. And I think it says something about KERA that these guests are more than willing and happy to spend an hour with us talking about, you know, their latest book or what they're into, because they know that KERA listeners are their audience too.
We would love to give you a copy of Stanley Crouch's new book, Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. This is actually part one of what will be a two-volume biography of Parker that Stanley Crouch is writing. This one is available to you with a contribution of $10 a month. You can do that very easily online at KERA.org, or you can go to 888-694-6931 and talk to the folks on the phone.
Yeah, Chris, you mentioned the $10 a month plan, and that's you can set that up as a sustaining membership. And if you are new to the station, what that really means is that you can just set it up to where whatever amount you're comfortable with is automatically deducted from your, you know, checking account, or you can have it billed to your credit card. And it just makes you know that you are supporting your public radio station really without even having to think about it every month. So we'd be happy to set that up for you. It's really easy to set up at KERA.org.
It's really simple. Once you unlatch from the idea that, hey, I can get this thing for free, and you sort of triumph about that, once you think that it's the right thing to do and that it's not that expensive if you set up one of these sustaining memberships where we just do a monthly draw, and recognize that the good things in the world that exist because people have made the effort to make them possible. And a little bit of money, if you are a regular listener, would be greatly appreciated around here. You hear how we put your money to work, so you have no fears as far as that goes. You can get in on the drawing that we have for a new iPad Air. There's about 20 minutes left before we make that drawing. You can get in at KERA.org or 888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
Very young Charlie Parker there in 1940 with the J. McShann Orchestra playing Body and Soul. My guest this hour is Stanley Crouch, whose new book is called Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. If you'd like to join us, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Stanley, is Parker hearkening back to Coleman Hawkins on that tune?
Very slightly. Mm-hmm.
Please continue. I'm sorry.
No, very, very slightly. He was beginning to hear his own melody line.
Yeah, talk a little bit about, first of all, this book, as we mentioned in the break, is sort of part one of what will be a two-volume biography. What made you decide to sort of start with the early part of his life and end the book when you did, before Parker has really entirely become who he will become?
Well, the amount of material I had was enough to make about a 700-page book, but I didn't want it to be that long in the first volume. Mm-hmm. I felt that it could effectively give one part of his life and also create his surroundings and his environment and the identity that he had as a Southwestern American. See, See, the Southwest is actually different from the Southeast or the West. People used to call it the West, but you know, it produced different kind of people. That's all you can say. I mean, but they are fundamentally connected to the American frontier, and they have a lot of things in their personalities that came out of the West. And in the book, I lay down that heritage as a person from the Midwest, because I don't think you can really get to who Charlie Parker was if you don't really understand those cities in the 19th century. And actually if you don't really understand how the women functioned in the West, you don't really get it, because there's a lot of misinformation about women in the West, which was, you know, that they, you know, they were basically, you know, the simple fact is this: many of the women who came West, they came from the East Coast, and they didn't ride in covered wagons. They actually walked alongside them. They fought the Indians. They got shot. They had babies. They died in large numbers. But so by the time they got where they were going, they started saying, now, "Look, you guys have to deal with something. We walked all the way here from the East Coast. We're not going to allow stand here and let you guys act like the fools you want to act like. We're not going for it." Mm-hmm. You know, so if you read real histories of the West, you find out that the West got settled because the women wanted it settled. You know, they're very different than the women in the Western movies, except the ones who are ready who are as ready to fight as the guys. Now Hollywood did stumble up on that every now and then, you know. But so what I mean is that the women that were around Charlie Parker, the women in the jazz world, the audiences, they had a certain kind of a feeling about men and women and what they actually owed each other and what they were responsible to do for each other, and it comes out in the music.
How would you characterize the way that Charlie Parker listened to other musicians?
Well, when he was a kid, he listened to them to try to figure out what they were doing, because he was excited by them and he admired them remarkably. So he studied the way they fingered the saxophone. He studied the way they breathe, the way that they use their mouths. He studied all of that. He studied the way they phrased, the way they played, because he wanted to be up there with them, but he wanted to get that feeling of freedom that all jazz musicians seek. See, because finally, freedom on the bandstand almost sounds as though you're not thinking at all about what you're playing. It just comes out right. Well, that's not true.
But sounds that way if you've never tried it. Is that it?
Yeah. No. You know, see, to get to that level of freedom, you have to play for so many hours and have learned so much that you're absolutely relaxed. And that was what Charlie Parker was looking for. And there were so many examples of it. you know, because that was part of what I wanted to do was show to the reader the kind of the level of excitement that he was experiencing when he listened to these other guys and the complexity of the scene. You know, it's like when he was a kid, when he was a little boy, not a little boy, when he was a teenager, and he was in the backyard behind the Reno Club where Lester Young, Joe Jones, Count Basie, they're playing, where the Whores used to sit on these benches. But the Whores, too, had a sense of beauty. Odd as that might seem, because when asked which one of those saxophone players did they like, they say, well, you know, I like that Lester Young because he plays that silky saxophone. And so what I mean is that the idea of human beings being able to touch other people in a beautiful way, or to present something in music that was not a sentimentalized, fraudulent version of beauty, but was actually beauty, people could hear that through classes, through races, through religions, through everything. They could hear that. They knew that that existed. And they had plenty of proof, because people got up on the bandstand every night and attempted to play something beautiful and touch the people with it. And so it's not, you know, that what Armstrong did, what Basie did, what Lester Young did, what Fred Astaire did, all of those people were doing, they were all reaching for the same thing, and the public wanted to hear it. They wanted to feel that come from that person, that individuality, and that universal feeling that seemed to say, well, this might be beautiful, but you know what? Some of this is for you. If you can hear it, you can take it. You can. It's yours. And so that feeling was very important during that time. I mean, we even have some of it now, although you wouldn't think we have it as a culture. We seem to be more. Well, I don't know. I think we kind of OD'd on science fiction and monster movies and obsessions with monsters, but there still is that desire for that kind of unsentimental beauty that you hear in the best of jazz musicians or the best of American artists in any profession.
If you could sit down with Charlie Parker, bring him back to life, sit down with him and ask him a single question, what would you want to know?
When is he playing next? I wouldn't want to ask him what he's playing. When is he playing next? if he arrives, that was what I would want to know. I wouldn't want to know where he was staying. I wouldn't want to know what suits he was going to wear. I wouldn't care about any of that. All I would want to do is be in the room where he's playing. Because I know that, see, if you go to hear something in person, even if it's recorded with the best equipment, there is something about being there present yeah. when the notes come out that technology cannot really capture, you know. Because, for instance, I've never heard any musician who sounds the same in a recording as he sounds on the bandstand. I've never heard it.
Stanley Crouch is president of the Louis Armstrong Educational Foundation and a columnist for the New York Times. His new book is called Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. Stanley, it's been such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. It is brought to this station. It is brought to North Texas. It is brought to the web by contributions from people just like you. Contributions online at kera.org or over the phone at 888-694-6931. If you would like to read Stanley Crouch's remarkable book on the beginning of Charlie Parker's musical career, it's called Kansas City Lightning. We have thank you. you gift copies available with a contribution at the level of $10 a month. Stephen Becker is with us now. Stephen, thank you as new producer for securing this interview. What a pleasure to talk to Stanley Crouch.
Yeah, it was really when I saw when our membership campaign was going to start and it aligned with this interview, I thought this is perfect because this is a book that A, our listeners, I think, would really enjoy, and B, it's just, it kind of says a lot about, I think, what KERA does. You know, we focus on the arts. That's one of our major focus. We also know that our listeners are interested in stuff like history and culture and diversity and all of those topics, and so many of them come through in this single book. So it's a great, I think, pledge, you know, gift that we can offer to our listeners. Again, that's for $120 contribution today, you can read along with us.
You know, you mentioned that Stanley Crouch, of course, was featured in Ken Burns Jazz, and he is such an interesting person to talk to. I felt like that interview could have gone in like 95 different fascinating directions. The book takes the time to sort of bring you there in a lot of ways and really explores kind of those interesting tangents that help you understand Charlie Parker. So we would highly recommend the book. We thank you for your contributions in the past, which have allowed us to bring this interview to you. And we would ask that if this is the kind of programming you value, if this is something that you believe ought to be available, whether online or over the airwaves, please make a contribution of support at kera.org or 888-694-6931.
You know, you still maybe have like a minute to get in before that 1 o'clock drawing,
like
or
maybe three or four minutes.
3 or 4 minutes. I don't have the clock right in front of me, but I think if you get going on it right now, you could probably get in. We're giving away 4 iPad Airs, and the first one's going to be drawn at 1 p.m. And if you have been thinking about, you know, wanting to try and win one of those, well, why not give yourself the best chance? Because if you make that contribution, you'll be entered to win all, you know, one of the 4. So, you know, if you wait another couple minutes, there's only going to be 3 left. And why wait if you're so interested in that iPad? You can get entered in at 888-694-6931 or by going online to kera.org. You know, we had a little post about how Dallas has one of the highest, if not the highest, penetration of tablet and smartphone usage. And I think some of that is maybe because of our membership campaigns. We always seem to be giving them away. But if you're the one person out there who doesn't have one yet, this is a good chance to get one.
888-694-6931 is the number, or kera.org. Public radio is something that we know that you value. You come to us every day with an open mind because you're curious. You want unbiased news and information. You want entertainment that is, you know, frankly, not the Real Housewives of whatever city has Real Housewives these days. There's nothing wrong with that stuff, but public radio is different. We really are serving people who are interested in lifelong learning, some of whom might watch Real Housewives, and that's fine too. But when you want smart content, when you want truly accurate news with a global staff to bring it to you, plus an ever-growing, highly distinguished staff of local journalists bringing you news about the North Texas region, you turn to KERA. Because you know you will find it there. You know that it is accurate. And your contribution makes it possible for us to serve you in this way.
I think we would both say that we're very proud to work here at KERA. And I know that it's, you know, we get a kick out of telling people that you run into, you know, they'll say, what do you do? I work at KERA. One of the number one comments I always get from people when I tell them that is I always feel smarter after I listen to KERA. And my response to them normally is, it's not that you feel smarter, it's that you are smarter after listening to KERA because, like you said, it's nothing but kind of good for you, information and news, and also just cultural stuff like our Stanley Crouch conversation. If that's the type of programming that's important to you, we'd love to have your support today at kera.org or by calling 888-694-6931.
You know, as a working parent, I do a lot of driving all around North Texas, and if I'm in the car and I have KERA on, I feel like it's never wasted time, even if I'm stuck in traffic, because it's almost like you are reading a really great magazine or a book as you move about the rest of your day. That's a service worth paying for at kera.org or at 888-694-6931. Thank you so much.